I'd like to shift our attention in this session from domestic policy to foreign policy. But the two topics are in fact inextricably intertwined in the case of the National Socialists. The NSDAP, and Hitler in particular, had in effect at the core of his own ideological thought a triangular relationship between racial policy, a desire to create Lebensraum or living space for the German people in Central and Eastern Europe, and third, a crusade against Bolshevism in the East. These three things were inextricably intertwined in Hitler's own thinking. A great many historians have tried somehow to separate them out and to argue, was Hitler more anti-Semitic or was he more anti-Marxist? Was he driven to attack the Soviet Union for ideological motives because it was the home of international Bolshevism, or for geopolitical reasons having to do with the desire for what the Germans call living space in the East? I think it's an exercise that's absolutely fruitless. I think in Hitler's own mind, these three things came together. That the desire for a expansion into the East, which is clearly stated in Mein Kampf and into an unpublished book that Hitler wrote in 1928-29 on foreign policy, makes quite clear that his notion was that Germany needed to be self-sufficient, that he wanted to create an economically and strategically self-sufficient Grossdeutsches Reich, a greater German Reich that would be capable of surviving an Allied blockade which had helped to bring Germany to its knees in 1914 to 1918. This meant, above all else, expansion to the East, the creation of a larger Eastern, Central, and Eastern European empire. But that expansion East, for Hitler, was more than simply traditional geopolitics. It was different from the Kaiser or Imperial Germany's invasion of the East. Because an invasion of Eastern Europe, and particularly of Russia with the great breadbasket of the Ukraine, also had an ideological dimension. Russia was the Soviet Union, was the home of international Bolshevism. So that for Hitler, there's a geopolitical element, but also an ideological dimension. A war against Russia would be an ideological war, and an ideological war to the finish. But there was a third dimension, or a third point in this triangular relationship, that was crucial for Hitler. This new greater German Reich would be a racial entity. It would be an Aryan, racially pure empire, which would provide the seed for the establishment of a master race in Europe and indeed in the world. So I think that one sees in Mein Kampf, one sees in Hitler's famous table talk, people close to Hitler were fond of jotting down his stray thoughts at times, and one has seen one sees these published in a number of things, particularly in a book called Hitler's Table Talk, in which it's clear that the linkages are made in his mind, that these three things operate as a single kind of variable. For Hitler, he rarely ever talked about Bolshevism. It was almost invariably Judeo-Bolshevism or Jewish Bolshevism. The two things came together. And his desire for Lebensraum or expansion in the East was clearly tied to an assault against the Soviet Union. We've come to think, after 1945 and our own experience in defeating the Nazis, of Hitler having an absolutely unquenchable thirst for expansion, that what the Nazis wanted to do was to dominate the world. There was a Nazi song that the SA was fond of singing that in German was "Heute dahut uns Deutschland und morgen die ganze Welt." Today Germany hears us, tomorrow the whole world. The SA, when they sang it often, would say "Heute gehört uns Deutschland und morgen die ganze Welt," which means today Germany belongs to us, tomorrow the whole world. Nonetheless, if one reads through Hitler's second book, the book on foreign policy, the unpublished book, and also read through Mein Kampf in the sections dealing with his view of world politics, it becomes quite clear that Hitler believed that envisioned a world in which there would be several great world empires, that there would be a system of world empires. Germany's position in this world would be to dominate the European continent. Germany would be the great hegemonic power of continental Europe. Britain would continue to have its far-flung empire. Hitler always believed that the British should have some special place in the constellation of world powers. He also was willing to grant, at least for a an unforeseeable period of time, the United States' role as a great power in international affairs, though Hitler believed that the United States was doomed, that a country with racial mixtures like the United States simply could not possibly, in the long run, sustain its position in world affairs. Nonetheless, Germany, Britain, the United States, and finally, and in a position that made absolutely no ideological sense from Hitler's point of view, he also saw the Japanese as dominating much of Asia. From a racial point of view, this made no sense unless one tried, as various Nazi theorists tried to do, to somehow argue about the Japanese being the Aryans of the Orient. They gave up on this. This didn't work. I think what one sees in this is, again, Hitler is not a systematic, to put it mildly, was not a systematic theoretical thinker. And one sees contradictions constantly as one moves back and forth from the sort of ideological side of his brain to the more pragmatic side of his actions. And so his view was of the world was that Germany was going to have a place that would be roughly equivalent to that of a superpower. The term didn't exist in the 1930s and 40s, obviously. If it had, I think Hitler's view was that Germany would play the role of like the United States or the Soviet Union has played after the Second World War. A superpower capable of intervening in any place around the globe, capable of affecting the politics of the world. All of this, of course, meant a dramatic revision of the Treaty of Versailles. Hitler, throughout his career in office in the 1930s and down to the outbreak of the war, publicly demanded equality and peace. What Hitler argued in all of Hitler's speeches on foreign policy, he always sort of would build himself up into a kind of crescendo about this, but they would always begin with a ritualistic retelling of Germany's ill treatment by the Allies after the Great War. He would argue that what Germany wanted now was nothing more than equality, to be on an equal footing with the French, the British, the Americans, and so on. That he wanted to live in peace. After all, as he pointed out, I was a soldier at the front. I know what war means. I know the devastation that it can bring. So that this was a standard staple of the Hitler speech on foreign policy. While he was saying this publicly, of course, Hitler was privately plotting more aggressive strategy. We get a sense of what Hitler's foreign policy was like and his style of foreign policy in the very first year of the Nazi, that the Nazis seized power. In 1933, Germany was a participant in a conference, international conference on disarmament. Hitler agreed to disarmament. Indeed, what Hitler offered was that Germany would completely disarm, get rid of its military altogether, if all the other powers followed suit. When, of course, arguing that what Germany wanted was nothing more than equality. Within 5 years, Germany would disband its military as long as the French, the English, the Russians, and so on did as well. When the French balked, as Hitler knew they would at this suggestion, Hitler withdrew from the disarmament conference and from the League of Nations, arguing that, well, you see, we've made a good faith offer, stating that all we want is to play on an equal footing with the other players in the international arena, but the French and the British are not at all interested. What Hitler needed and what he claimed and demanded from the very beginning was a revision of the Treaty of Versailles. The Treaty of Versailles was the most hated document in Germany from the communists to the Nazis in the 1920s and early 1930s. And In the 1930s, Hitler was able to count on international opinion to a certain extent. In the late 20s, a Harvard historian, Sidney B. Fay, published a two-volume work that was of one of those rare books by historians that has an impact on anything. I say with a certain amount of chagrin and envy. Fay published a book called The Origins of the Great War, in which he argued that indeed the Allies had been wrong at Versailles, that the Germans were not solely responsible for the outbreak of the war, the war guilt clause was therefore misplaced, reparations were therefore illegitimate. I mean, he didn't argue this, but these were the implications. And one sees people like John Maynard Keynes arguing in the Carthaginian Peace that the Versailles Treaty had been too harsh. There was a sense in the West, particularly in Britain and in the United States, not in France, but in Britain and the United States, that the peace treaty had indeed been a dictated peace, that it had been unfair. And precisely the harshness of the treaty had been responsible for much of the Nazi popularity and of the Nazi rise to power in Germany. There was, therefore, an international climate which was conducive to Hitler thinking about a revision of the treaty. And he played on this tirelessly, pointing out that all Germany wanted to do was to return to the fold as an equal partner in world affairs. In 1935, the Germans, having prepared the stage for this action, announced on March 1st the establishment of a German air force. This was in response to British plans announced publicly to expand their own military, so that Hitler was able to argue that, well, we have to now introduce an air force because the British are planning to expand. We already see that the Allies aren't serious about equality, and so for our own self-protection, Germany needs to have an air force. An air force was expressly forbidden by the Treaty of Versailles. The British complained. The League of Nations complained, individual states complained, but no action was taken. 2 weeks later, on March 15th, 1935, Hitler announced the reintroduction of conscription in Germany and the intention of increasing the size of the army to 36 divisions and 550,000 troops. It was a complete renunciation of the clauses on rearmament embedded in the Treaty of Versailles. It was both of these measures, but particularly the reintroduction of the draft in Germany, was wildly popular inside of Germany. The Gestapo reports emphasized this. Because what Hitler was doing here was tweaking the noses of the Allies. Here was somebody who, unlike Gustav Stresemann or the politicians of the Weimar Republic, here was somebody who absolutely had broken the treaty and was daring the Allies to do something about it. And the Allies had done nothing. These measures provoked a protest from the League of Nations. Britain, France, even Italy raised objections to this obvious breach of the Treaty of Versailles. But that's all. No active steps were taken to undo Nazi actions. Indeed, in the immediate aftermath, Britain actually signed a naval agreement with the Germans, the Anglo-German Naval Agreement, in which Germany pledged to keep its fleet to one-third the size of Great Britain's, and that Germany would be able to build submarines of an equal number with that of England. This was a clear breach of the Treaty of Versailles, and not only was it a breach, but the British had joined the Germans in doing it. The French were absolutely beside themselves. Now, not only had Germany flaunted the treaty, but here one of the signatories of the Treaty of Versailles was actually helping them. The British were cutting a special deal with the Germans. What was going on? The French at this point were frantic and furious with the British. And here we see, I think, one of the legacies of the 1920s. The English had become convinced that the French were too ambitious, too troublesome, had finally decided in the mid-1930s that the League of Nations was just not an effective organization. The Americans had bailed out already, and that therefore they were going to make a special arrangement. Also, roughly the same time, Mussolini invaded Ethiopia, which ended any kind of hope of the collective security involving the Italians. The French and the British, the League of Nations, complained about this Italian burst of Italian imperialism. But what it did, of course, was to begin to drive a wedge between the English and the French and the Italians. Until this point, the three had by and large cooperated. The League of Nations was mobilized by the British, but only half-hearted sanctions were extended toward or imposed upon Mussolini's Italy. Hitler, of course, congratulated the Duce on his successful invasion and his attempt to reestablish a Roman imperium in Africa. These breaches of the treaty were followed in 1936 in the spring, in March, by the remilitarization of the Rhineland. Yet another breach of the Treaty of Versailles. The Rhineland had been declared a demilitarized zone by the treaty. It was German territory. It was part of the German state. But according to the Treaty of Versailles, no German troops were to be allowed in the Rhineland. This was important because what this allowed was if the Germans engaged in any sort of aggression or appeared to do so or to be on the brink of doing so, the French would be able to move directly into the Rhineland, occupy the strategic area without any sort of German opposition. On March 7th, Hitler had given the order for German troops to march across the bridges into the Rhineland, occupying the west bank of the Rhine. It was a devastating blow to the French ability to intervene in Germany. France had constructed a series of alliances in Eastern Europe that had credibility only so long as the Rhineland remained demilitarized. As soon as the German troops moved into the Rhineland, the French now would have to invade Germany. There was no clear way that the French could in any way restrain German ambitions in the East. And I do mean all of Hitler's generals and his top diplomatic advisors pleaded with him not to do this. They argued that the Allies would react and that if one French division were sent into Germany, that the whole German army would collapse, that there was no way Germany could militarily defend itself if France alone reacted to the invasion of the Rhineland or the remilitarization of the Rhineland. This little episode was very important to Hitler because what it did was to convince him that his generals were timid, and it would be the beginning of a whole series of episodes in which his judgment would be proven correct, and the judgment of his diplomatic and military advisors spurious. Hitler declared that the remilitarization of the Rhineland was important because the French had signed an agreement with the Soviet Union as part of an aggressive French attempt to encircle Germany. And in typical Hitlerian fashion, after having remilitarized the Rhineland as a breach of Versailles, he very generously offered to sign a new treaty with Belgium, France, and Great Britain, guaranteeing all the borders of Western Europe. So you get these acts of aggression on the one hand, and a rhetoric that is cooperative, almost peace-loving, coming out of Berlin. The remilitarization of the Rhineland was serious then for two reasons. One is that it weakened military reservations within Germany about Hitler's judgment, and it desperately weakened the French Eastern Alliance system. The remilitarization of the Rhineland and the breaching of the armaments clauses of Versailles were tremendously popular in Germany. One of the difficult things about teaching history or telling history is that one has to follow a narrative, follow a theme through a narrative trajectory, and then you follow another one. You have to try to sort of keep in mind that these things are going on at the same time as the anti-Semitic measures of the regime. So that many Germans who felt that some of the Nazi racial policies were sordid and had misgivings about those, that their feelings about the regime had to be balanced because of these great foreign policy successes that were going on simultaneously, one of which, of course, came in 1936, and that was the Olympic Games in Berlin, which were a tremendous success inside of Germany. When we think of the 1936 Olympic Games, I feel confident in saying that I suspect I know what most of you think of, We think of Jesse Owens and his tremendous performance at the 36 Olympics. The problem is that the Germans won the 1936 Olympic Games. I mean, the calculation of medals, something that the Nazis triumphed. They won all of these, for me, bizarre things. We fence and swim and throw things, and not the big track and field events that we tend to think about when we think of the Olympics. But nonetheless, I always say this with trepidation because there's always a fencer in the audience who takes who is unhappy with this. Nonetheless, the Olympic Games proved to be a tremendous, proved tremendously popular in Germany. And the sort of embarrassment that we always see of Hitler not wanting to have to be confronted with Jesse Owens as proof positive of the falseness of his own racial doctrine was something that, of course, was not a part of the Nazi depiction of the Olympics or their use of those games for domestic purposes. And it also was, it seemed to verify Germany's return to great power and prestige in the world. The world had come to Berlin, and Hitler's own manipulation of the Olympics for domestic purposes was quite striking. 36 was also important because of the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War, which again would help to cement the growing intimacy between Mussolini's Italy and Hitler's Germany. Mussolini's intervention on the side of Franco along with the Germans would lead to a closer cooperation between the two fascist powers in Europe. All through the early 30s then, Hitler had claimed publicly that he was interested in a revision of the treaty. He was interested in reestablishing German parity, German prestige. However, in 1937, we get a rare glimpse behind the curtains. At a meeting on November 5th, 1937, a meeting attended by Hitler's top military and foreign policy staffs, Hitler laid out a game plan for his next diplomatic steps. The minutes from this meeting, which were top secret, no official minutes were kept, but a Colonel Hossbach, Friedrich Hossbach, kept notes of the meeting, and it's gone down in history as the Hossbach Memorandum. Hitler laid out his foreign policy ambitions. He hoped to achieve Lebensraum in the East, living space in the East, by 1943 to 45. Germany would have to be prepared to engage in a war of aggression in Eastern Europe to achieve living space by that date. The justification for this is also revealing. He didn't make the case on the basis of geopolitics, but rather argued that the health of German racial stock and the access to food made an expansion into Eastern Europe imperative. What this would mean, he argued, was first the annexation of Austria and Czechoslovakia. Both these two states would have to come into the German orbit. Whether it meant outright annexation or not was not clear. But that clearly there was going to be military expansion. Hitler was not talking about a diplomatic move. He argued that he would prepare the diplomatic stage, but that the military had to be ready to implement his directives. This would probably mean, he calculated, or it could mean, war with France and England as well. It was his job, he argued, to isolate Austria and Czechoslovakia. Army personnel who were present, as well as Foreign Office officials, found this presentation absolutely breathtaking. Foreign Office officials and the leadership of the Army both complained that this was utterly impossible, that it was simply too much, that it was too grandiose, that Germany could not be prepared militarily for this kind of grandiose scheme, and that certainly not by 1943, 44, or 1945. That Germany's military planning was not sufficient, that Germany's economy would not be ready, and so both foreign policy officials and army officers complained, particularly Generals Blomberg and Fritsch and the foreign minister Baron von Neurath. Shortly after this, in early 1938, Blomberg and Fritsch were removed from their positions at the top of the German military. General Blomberg, a man who had been devoted to his army post for most of his life, made a very bad marriage in January of 1938 to a woman who apparently had been on very familiar terms with a large segment of the German army. And this marriage was used to discredit him. A private matter was brought to the fore. Blomberg was forced to resign his position, and he was discredited. At the same time, General Fritsch, the other man who had lodged serious complaints about Hitler's plans, was now accused of homosexuality. The SS produced a file to show that General Fritsch was indeed an active homosexual and therefore not worthy of his position. It was clear from the very beginning of the case that this was an instance of mistaken identity, but it didn't stop Himmler or the SS. They had been given a very clear signal. Fritsch also was removed from his position. And in 1938, Hitler appointed himself commander-in-chief of all armed forces and promoted a man by the name of Wilhelm Keitel to be the new chief of the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, or the high command of the military. Shortly thereafter, he also replaced Baron von Neurath, an old holdover from the previous regime, with his own foreign minister, a man by the name of Joachim von Ribbentrop, who had, to this point in his career, not particularly distinguished himself by his command of foreign policy. He was, however, a committed National Socialist and a pliable tool in Hitler's hands. Thus, by early 1938, Hitler had purged the top leadership of the army and the Foreign Office of those people who had raised objections to his stated aim of aggression in Eastern Europe in the foreseeable future. And 1938 would be a particularly active year in the foreign policy of the Third Reich. It would begin with the situation in Austria and the so-called Anschluss with Austria in the spring of 1938. The Third Reich had a treaty with Austria, dating from 1936, a treaty in which Germany recognized Austrian sovereignty, but that Austria agreed that the internal Nazi opposition in Austria would receive representation in the government. The situation in Austria was always tense. The Nazis had attempted a coup d'etat in 1934, which had failed. After 36 and the treaty with Austria, there was tremendous tension between the Austrian government, headed by Kurt von Schuschnigg, an authoritarian government, and the Nazi opposition there. Schuschnigg's dictatorial government was unpopular. He was opposed not only by the Nazis, but also by the socialists. And there was considerable fear in Austria, particularly as 1937 turned into 1938, of another Nazi uprising in Austria. In this situation in early 1938, Schuschnigg turned to the British and to the Italians to see if he could find some sort of international guarantee for Austrian sovereignty. He felt that there was going to be, he sensed that there was going to be pressure coming from Berlin and from the Austrian Nazis, and he therefore sought international guarantees of Austrian sovereignty. Schuschnigg was unable to win any kind of international guarantee, but his efforts to do so infuriated Hitler. Hitler stated publicly that this was bad faith. What was Schuschnigg doing? Didn't he know that Germany and Austria had a treaty, etc., etc., etc.? Franz von Papen, ex-chancellor of Germany, reappears at this time as ambassador to Austria and persuaded Hitler and Schuschnigg to engage in what we would now call summitry. That maybe the thing to do was to bring these two leaders together for a personal discussion, person-to-person discussion, to iron out differences. He therefore persuaded Schuschnigg to meet with Hitler at Hitler's mountain retreat outside of Berchtesgaden on February 12, 1938. I can't resist the description of Schuschnigg's trip up. Schuschnigg went by train from Vienna up to Munich and then was taken in a car cavalcade out to Berchtesgaden. The meeting was not to take place in Hitler's own personal residence on the Obersalzberg, just outside of Berchtesgaden, but rather at another location close by. Schuschnigg was taken in a motorcade of cars around and around this mountain, up and up and up, until finally arrives at a large sort of parking lot filled with official vehicles of one sort or another. And then there he's out, he's on the side of an Alp. On the side of the mountain, he sees a kind of entrance that looks sort of like the opening to a cave. With SS people in dress SS uniforms, the black uniform, white gloves, the helmet and bayonets out with their rifles at parade rest. Schuschnigg is then escorted down a long corridor in the mountain. It is in fact a tunnel going into the mountain, lit by torches with SS guards all the way down through this tunnel. He was then taken into a small room, actually about as big as this platform that I'm standing on. With silver all around it, or gold rather, and furniture, but an odd sort of hum that he could hear in the room. And then he realized that the room was moving. In fact, Schuschnigg was being taken up through the mountain in an elevator. The door of the room swung open, and there he was on the top of this mountain to be greeted by Adolf Hitler, Hermann Göring, and the entire German general staff, which had been assembled to meet with the Chancellor of Austria. This kind of meeting was typical Hitlerian diplomacy. Schuschnigg was there, he was isolated, he was alone, effectively alone, on the top of this mountain with Hitler, who then proceeded to tell him that it was all he could do, all he, Adolf Hitler, could do to restrain his general staff, which wanted to smash into Austria, take the country tomorrow, and that Schuschnigg was, in fact, encouraging the German military to act. The German people couldn't stand for this any longer, and that he himself was the only possible restraint. Hitler demanded National Socialist freedom of action. He wanted the appointment of the head of the Nazi Austrian party, a man by the name of Arthur Seyss-Inquart, as Minister of Security and the Interior, in other words, to make a Nazi head of the Austrian police. He wanted a promise of a coordinated foreign policy, an exchange of army officers, and a general amnesty for all of those Nazis who were cooling their heels in Austrian jails. Schuschnigg managed to get himself out of this this Adler's horse, this eagle's nest, as it was called, back to Vienna, arguing, well, I can't do anything about this here. I can't make any commitments. I have to go back and confer with my government. And then startled Hitler on March 9th by declaring a plebiscite to be held in 4 days in Austria to decide on whether or not Austria wished to have an Anschluss, or a linkage with Germany. Hitler now really flew into a fury. He ordered military preparations for an invasion of Austria, and demanded a postponement of the plebiscite and the dismissal of Schuschnigg. The Austrian government, looking for international guarantees, found again that no one was willing to step in to guarantee Austrian sovereignty, and on March 12th, Seyss-Inquart, the head of the Nazi party in Austria, was appointed chancellor in Vienna, and Hitler was invited by telephone to come to Vienna. The text of the call and the letter that went to Hitler was actually dictated by Göring over the telephone to Vienna and then phoned back to Berlin. Hitler stopped in his old hometown of Linz in Austria overnight. It is not clear at this point whether Hitler actually intended to annex Austria. There was some talk, certainly the head of Seyss-Inquart and the Austrian Nazis believed that there would be a very close working alliance, that Austria would be a kind of satellite state of the greater German Reich. Hitler, however, apparently overcome by the tremendous reception that he received both in Linz and then at the Bauhausplatz in Vienna, announced on the spur of the moment that his intention was for Austria to come Heimensreich, for Austria to come home to the Reich, that Austria would be annexed outright to Germany as the Eastern March, or the Ostmark. Hitler was received to a tumultuous welcome by an enormous crowd on March 12th. On March 13th, Himmler descended on Vienna, and within days, over 76,000 arrests were made in Vienna and the other major cities of Austria as potential opposition was effectively squelched. Also, Austrian Jews began to be rounded up in preparation for expulsion. No sooner had the Austrian crisis subsided than a new issue moved on to the front burner. During the Anschluss, Hitler and Goering had worried about the possibility of Czech intervention or military mobilization. And in the mountainous region around the rim of Bohemia that extends into Germany was the Sudetenland, an area settled very heavily by ethnic Germans who had begun clamoring with Nazi support several years earlier for some sort of autonomy within Czechoslovakia based on the principle of national self-determination of peoples. The Nazis now encouraged the Sudeten Germans to make impossible demands on the Czech government. There were numerous cases of clashes between Czech police and German agitators in the Sudetenland. Persistent rumors of troop movements in the late spring of 1938, German troop movements, at last provoked Czechoslovakia in late May to order a mobilization of its troops. War seemed imminent, but in this instance, after May 20th, 1938, the Nazis actually backed off, in part because of military reservations about the plausibility of an invasion of Czechoslovakia. The Czechs had a very well-trained, well-equipped army and had very good defensive positions. In the meantime, Hitler, at the Nuremberg rally, promised the head of the Sudeten Germans military support, and Konrad Henlein, the head of the Sudeten Germans, called for a secession of the Sudetenland and its annexation by Germany. He called for revolt in the Sudetenland. The Czechs moved to squelch the Nazi agitation there, and the crisis once again heated up. It was at this point that the British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, intervened. Chamberlain announced his decision in early September to travel to Germany. He would be the first British Prime Minister to do so. He would take a plane trip to meet Hitler, not in Berlin. Hitler suggested an alternative site, not in Munich, but you guessed it, at the Eagle's Nest on the top of the Alp where Hitler had entertained Schuschnigg. Chamberlain went to the Obersalzberg outside of Berchtesgaden on September 15th, 1938, and promised his support for the incorporation of the Sudetenland into Germany. Chamberlain was convinced by Hitler that this was a legitimate demand. We were talking here about Germans, ethnic Germans, who wanted to come Heim ins Reich, to return to the Reich. This could be justified on the basis of the national self-determination of peoples. And Chamberlain argued that he believed that the British public and the international public would understand. France was brought into the fold. Chamberlain was able to use his influence with Daladier to win French acquiescence. But Hitler very quickly escalated his demands at another follow-up meeting at Bad Godesberg in very late September, arguing that he wanted to see immediate entry of German troops into the Sudetenland. He wasn't going to wait for any sort of vote in the Sudetenland. He wanted German troops there. At a speech at the Sportspalast in Berlin, Hitler demanded agreement within 48 hours, and Britain and France actually mobilized their troops. At this point in September of 1938, the world stood perched on the precipice of war. Europe, it looked like, was about to go to war for the second time in a generation over an issue of Central Europe or Eastern Europe. In Britain and in France, there was a tremendous sense of depression that settled on I think, both populations. did Britain really want to go to war over a strip of territory in Czechoslovakia, a tiny strip of territory that most Britons couldn't find on a map, that was, after all, ethnically German, that should have been probably part of Germany if the Treaty of Versailles had really operated on the basis of the national self-determination of peoples? Could Europe go to war with good conscience a second time and see millions more people die in order for a small rectification of a border? I think this is a key consideration as one thinks about what Chamberlain was attempting to do in Munich. There was also the realization that the United States simply was not a factor. The British didn't feel that they could rely on the United States. We'd opted out of international security arrangements in the 20s and were very much isolationist in the 30s. Chamberlain's belief was that if the Allies, in good faith, fulfilled legitimate demands on the part of the Germans, that war could be avoided. They had to be legitimate demands, things that one could argue on the basis of the principles enunciated at Versailles. And the Sudetenland, Chamberlain argued, was one of those. It was at this juncture, with Europe on the verge of war, that Mussolini intervened. Mussolini having pounded his chest and rattled his saber for over 10 years, Mussolini was not ready to go to war with England and France over the Sudetenland. He pleaded with Hitler to hold a conference with the major powers, and as I think we all know, in October of 1938, England, France, Germany, and Italy met in Munich. In the conference that produced the scene that is, I think, indelibly imprinted in our collective memories of Chamberlain upon his return to England, waving the treaty and saying, "I believe this means peace in our time." At the Munich conference, agreement was made that Sudetenland would be ceded directly to Germany. The Czechs, interestingly enough, were not invited, nor was the Soviet Union, which had a treaty with the Czechs. The initial response to Chamberlain's action and to the Munich conference, there was enormous relief in Europe. Chamberlain had done what the diplomats of 1914 should have done. He'd walked the extra mile. He'd left no stone unturned. He'd gone to Germany directly and he had saved the peace. But at what cost? In Germany, an opposition had been growing within the army around General Ludwig Beck, that was convinced in 1938 that Hitler's policies were leading to folly, that an invasion of Czechoslovakia would lead to defeat, and were therefore, Beck had already begun discussions with a number of other generals for the possible overthrow of the National Socialist regime. Beck was astonished when the Allies caved in at Munich, and the military opposition at that point dissolved. The Munich conference had another important implication in the Soviet Union, where Stalin, looking at the Allies in Munich, came to the conclusion that the West was absolutely weak, that all Chamberlain was interested in doing was diverting Nazi attention to the East, and that there was no hope for any salvation of or protection for the Soviet Union to be expected from England and France. Hitler also came away from the Munich conference convinced that he was dealing, as he put it, with worms, that Chamberlain had no backbone, no spine. If one sees the photographs of that final session of the Munich conference where you see Mussolini, Chamberlain, Hitler, and Daladier, there's Mussolini beaming, obviously relieved that his troops are not going to have to be called upon. There's Chamberlain, self-satisfied. There's Hitler, looking like the cat that swallowed the canary. And then there's Daladier. And the look of anguish on that man's face is worth 1,000 words. He realized, I think, what the Munich conference had done. He realized that he who sups with the devil had better have a long spoon, but that there was no hope for France in this situation. 3 weeks after the Munich conference had saved Europe from war, Hitler issued commands to his military to begin preparations for an invasion of the rump state of Czechoslovakia. And in March of 1939, German troops invaded Czechoslovakia in an an egregious breach, not only of any kind of international law, but of the spirit of Munich. After the invasion of Czechoslovakia, there could be no talk of legitimate demands. This was not a legitimate revision of the Treaty of Versailles based on the national self-determination of peoples. It was absolute, sheer, naked aggression. In the immediate aftermath of that action, Britain and France, of course, would issue their guarantees to Poland, which seemed to be next on the Nazi menu. And indeed, the Nazis had begun making plans for some sort of military action in the East. The key to the diplomatic situation in the late summer of 1939, and we'll conclude with this, was not to be found in Warsaw, nor was it to be found in London or in Paris or in Washington. The key to the diplomatic situation in the summer of 1939 was in Moscow. The English and the French came with too little and too late. On August 24th, 1939, Joachim von Ribbentrop and Molotov, the Soviet foreign minister, signed a non-aggression pact, which effectively divided Eastern Europe into spheres of influence and removed the last possible barrier to Nazi aggression in Eastern Europe. The signing of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact put Poland right in the sights of National Socialist guns. And on September 1st, 1939, Germans awoke to the news that at daybreak, Polish units had attacked a radio station on the German frontier and that the Germans had been returning fire. The Second War had begun.